Hello, and thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast. For the last year, I have been using really almost exclusively a Sony A6000 for a lot of the production workflow that I go through. And a lot of that is like product photography, where I'm using an A6000 and a flash system to try and produce photographs, probably 200, 300 a day, something like that, that I'm trying to then take, process on a computer, and then put up online, in as simple of a workflow as I can. But for the last year, I've been using this Sony A6000. It works really well for the simple photograph system that I've been using. But I was thinking about it, really, the A6000 is probably one of the best, most inexpensive camera systems that you can grab onto right now. With the fewest number of like odd situations that it'll throw you into. If this was my first camera, I would be blown away with how capable and how useful, how many good images I'm able to get out of even just a more basic kit system of, but just in the exposures and the way the computer handles itself, the way the sensor itself really captures the quality of those colors, I've really been impressed with it. But it comes to my point, though, a little bit. Now that there's the Sony A6300, A6500, and I think A6900, is that right? Does that sound right? I think there's an A6900 out there. That was kind of like the higher-end one where, shoots the 5K video or something like that. It's got a gajillion autofocus points and a little stabilizer or something. But I think that's like the more modern version of it. The A6000 maybe now is like a 2015 camera. That's ancient in camera years maybe. But I've really been happy with it still. I know that the A6500 is where you get into some of the special features. Like if you're a vlogger, it has a way better video autofocus system than the A6500 that you might be interested in. It also is the camera that has the microphone input. That's an important feature. The A6000 has no external microphone input or headphone jack output. Like I have the A7R right here that does have some of those video outputs. I think the A7S line has even more video outputs. Like it has like S-log video out. I don't even know what that means. Apparently it's supposed to be, super high quality. Wow. Not rad. But there's more options and stuff that you get with it. But if you're starting as a vlogger and you want to spend less than $1,000 and you really want to get a solid camera that you can do 4K footage with, I think the A6500 line and up is definitely the way to go. If you're doing photographs or HD video production and you're just looking to get started, man, you could get a ton of production done like I have in the last year with just an A6000. So just a little bit of information you can get them used now, gosh, for like $300. It's awesome.
You can see more of my work at billynewmanphoto.com. You can check out some of my photo books on Amazon. I think you can look up Billy Newman under the authors section there and see some of the photo books on film, on the desert, on surrealism, on camping. Some cool stuff over there.
Really trying to do a lot of scouting stuff, which I've enjoyed too. Doing some scouting stuff through the summertime has been pretty cool, where I'm really trying to go through some of these back roads. I'm trying to mark spots on the map where there's good campsites, which I hadn't really done before. There's a lot of places I've driven, a lot of roads I've been on, and especially, backcountry roads, two Forest Service roads, BLM roads. And I know a lot of good dispersed camping areas. And really, I understand the context of how to find those areas so much better now that I'm older than when I was young. I mean, when I was young and I'd go camping with my dad, we'd go out to Eastern Oregon, we'd find some spots, and they had known about those spots since, he was a kid and he was going over there and hunting camps and stuff with his grandpa. So it's cool for me to get to go over to those same spots and get to check out that area and stuff. But I think there's been, or at least when I was a kid, I didn't really understand the land, the public land rights that you have and really how those are organized, like how public lands are organized and what you can do on them and sort of how it operates. I didn't really understand the difference between national forest land and BLM land or national park land and state park land or wilderness areas. National wildlife refuge areas. Man, there's just so many different distinctions of different things. And then also just private property. So I didn't really have a clear recollection of any of those things. And really a lot of time when it's public land, you can go on it, but there's some things you can't do on it. Like either maybe hunt in some circumstances, like a national park or I think you can't discharge a firearm inside a national park, but for specifically permitted events, maybe probably national wildlife refuges, I think those hunting opportunities are limited also. Though you can still do some things in those areas. I think you have to get permitted and you have to draw a tag for that location, I think is what it is. But yeah, it's kind of interesting sort of learning about that, learning how these things go, and also finally getting some maps that you can use that you can kind of trust better while you're in the backcountry. I think that's something that's really helped me kind of understand where I can go and what I can do. And I've had those map books, you know, like that 50 page or 100 page book of Oregon. And, you know, every page is a 25 mile map of that area. It's always super useful how they kind of grid out everything and show you the mile by mile marking and the topography of the area, the different little roads and stuff. But even those roads, those map makers still got things wrong. I remember too, you know, back in like, was it 2004? I think we were out in an area in southern Oregon near the Nevada border. Was it Drew's Reservoir? Somewhere south of Gearhart Mountain. And I remember we were on some little road. I don't even know if it was a national forest area. I think it was just is in between private and public lands as it kind of jumps back and forth in those pretty remote areas. All of it is just remote desert and forest and sagebrush and juniper. But some of it goes into like ranch land that's more managed, and some of it cuts back into BLM land as those little roads sort of meander through it. But I remember being out there and noticing that the map on the page was just totally different than the map or the real world ground truth of where the road went. And I thought, oh, whoa, yeah, you can't really trust the maps to show you the information that you want to see when you need it. Other times too, you know, you'll see like, it shows there's a road right here. Good deal. We'll take that road. Well, you know, it shows it. It's on the map. So you cut down there, you get on the road, and then it's washed out like crazy, or it's super bumpy and just a terrible ride. But it's the same green roads, the same label, the same marking as the road next to it that was graded it's not paved, right? It's graded gravel. They put more gravel down, I think is what I'm trying to say. They've made it an easier going road to drive on. But then you get those washboard sections out there. I don't know if you guys have been on that, where you're driving around in the Forest Service roads and those gravel roads. And I think it's a natural process of erosion that occurs that creates these waves in the material. You know, as the rainwater comes down, it sort of naturally over time generates these little ripples. And that's the washboard effect that you get when you're driving. That's also the thing that kind of kicks your car sideways when you're going a little too fast on a gravel road. That's what I started doing today. I think I kicked it pretty hard side, or you know, like it was pretty loose on the traction, and it was starting to tip sideways in my truck. And so I slowed down and threw it into four-wheel drive after that, and was able to cruise around out here pretty freely. Yeah, I wanted to talk on this podcast about hanging out in the Fremont National Forest, and I just got finished with a huge thunderstorm that came through. It just really finished raining a little bit ago. I think when I arrived here today at this meadow, it was still a few hours before sunset, so I walked around and kind of went along the perimeter of the meadow, and then I noticed that, you know, I mean, it's cloudy. It's been kind of cloudy today, and there's been thunderheads that have been building up over the location that I've been. Ever since I kind of came over the pass of the Cascades, I've been in like a pretty solid string of thunderheads that have sort of coalesced into a big mass over the Cascades. Some of it here over the Fremont National Forest, whatever mountains these are that I'm in. And yeah, it seems like this section of Eastern Oregon was getting hit with a good summer August thunderstorm today, which was kind of fun to sit through and go through. It was cool. I got rained on pretty hard earlier when I was driving over, and I thought I'd get out here and be a little bit more free of it, but it seemed like that storm kind of drifted over this way and then was sort of drifting north from here. And yeah, it was a new system, but man, there was just a bunch of lightning that was coming through and huge cracks of thunder, just big, deep rumbles. I haven't heard thunder like that in years and years, probably, you know, where it just kind of stays and like hangs and rolls for 10 seconds, 15 seconds, it seems like, you know, where you just really kind of like, whoa, can it really still be just cracking and rumbling and rolling? And there was enough lightning activity that was going on there where you'd hear thunder. I mean, it was almost like 45 minutes there where there was just a crack and a roll of thunder. almost continuously. Like it was pretty intense. It's really, I think, one of the more strong lightning storms I've been in a while. But that's sort of how it goes out here when you're at these higher elevations. I think I'm floating around up in the 5,100 feet or so above sea level. And so it just means I'm up in the mountains where these thunderstorms get started. You know, they get their, I think that's where they all kind of coalesce over these big mountaintops and then float over in the hot weather. I don't really understand the weather enough to say I know how a thunderstorm starts or doesn't start. Now I've just gotten cold enough. I'm trying to throw a jacket on. I know. You got to live through it. I'm really camping. It's been good. But I'm going to be out here for two nights, I think, is what I'm going to do. And then tomorrow I'll cruise out and I'll try and hit some of these Forest Service roads for a bit, drive around, do some exploring, mark a couple spots on the map as I'm cruising around. I think that'll be a good time. But yeah, I haven't been out here before. I think I've heard of a couple friends that have been out in this area that have done some, I think they did a couple scouting trips for a hunting trip that they were going on in the fall. I think this is an area where one of my friends goes. I think they try and draw a tag for, not this area. I think it's a drainage over from here. But I think I've heard about this area a couple times from people talking about it. So yeah, it's cool. It's a cool spot. I was out taking pictures earlier, taking some photographs. I've been working mostly, probably for almost a year and a half now. I've been working a lot with this 17 to 40 millimeter wide angle Canon lens. And it's a pretty inexpensive lens. I think you can get it for like $400, maybe a little less if you're lucky and you get it on a sale time. Sometimes in the fall, as we're kind of ramping down toward Thanksgiving, I think you can get some good deals on it. But that's, yeah, it's sort of in the $400 range. I think sometimes maybe it's more around $500 or something. But I picked it up a couple years ago when I was starting to do real estate photography. I was working for Airbnb for a while, where they had hired me as a photographer to go into these Airbnb Plus listings and get a new set of photographs. That was interesting, kind of learning about how specific they wanted all of those photographs and this really specific art style and you know, format of it. And that was fine. It was interesting to do for a while. But what was cool is I picked up that lens to get in and do that work. But really after that, I've been appreciating how much I can do with that wide angle lens. And then, you know, 40 millimeters isn't way different than 50 millimeters. It's certainly different for the effects of portraits and stuff. But when I'm out here doing landscape stuff and I'm trying to take pictures of a lot of this stuff is kind of sketch photos too, where I'm sort of going around at midday. I'm taking some photos of some different things. I want some camp photos in my truck and my little cooler set up in the back here. So all that's been good. In addition to that, the astrophotography stuff that I can do with it is pretty cool because it drops down to the 17 millimeters. It's an autofocus lens. It's a sealed lens. It's pretty good in most ways. And I've really noticed over time that I'm not as absolute of a mandate for me to be shooting at a really wide open f-stop. You know, if I'm shooting at a wide open aperture, almost all my photos early on were at 1.8 or 2.0 or 2.8 or something. And I would do that really because I was really trying to get, because I didn't have very many lenses, I was really trying to get as much effect out of that bokeh, out of that soft background as I could. So I was really trying to lean into that and get some photos with it. And I noticed with my camera and equipment at the time that it just looked better. It just did look better when it was at, you know, f1.8. I think I just had that nifty 50 Nikon 50 millimeter for the longest time. That's what I did my early trips on, and did a lot of my portfolio building stuff on that. But I've got a different 50 millimeter lens with me now. I've got it on my film camera in my bag right now, which I need to take out too. And I'm trying to finish a roll of Ektar film. It's been on there for a while. And I've enjoyed shooting it. It's cool. It's a new Canon camera to me, at least. I got it used on KEH and spent, I don't know, $35 on it, $10 to ship it. And it takes a weird battery, too. It's one of those 90s film cameras, and it has this weird, it almost looks like a battery pack. It's almost like two double A's, if they were a little fatter, that are bonded together in this little plastic pack. And then you pop that in there and shoot for a little while, I guess, and it runs a meter okay. So I'm getting by with it. But I've noticed the film camera stuff. It's fun to have an awesome film camera. It'd be cool to have a Leica and all the lenses I wanted. But a lot of the time with that, you know, I have the good lenses. I have this newer like Canon L glass that I get to shoot through, and for film photos and for the variety of image or the variety of lenses I have, you know, I can do telephoto, I can do prime, I can do really wide angle. All with the modern digital Canon lenses that have, you know, chips in them that read well, that meter well, that make contact with that send information back and forth, or at least from the lens to the camera, I think. Is that how it works? That works in the autofocus stuff for the digital camera. This is autofocus. So yeah, it's an autofocus digital camera. It's sending information back. It's working. Yeah. That makes sense, yeah. So it's cool. Like that's something I didn't really have available to me for a long time. You know, I think when I've probably on this podcast, if you go way back in the archives, I'm talking a lot about film with a Nikon F4. You know, I mean, that just had autofocus. That was the first camera, like 88, to get autofocus. Period. So it's cool to have that in a more flexible way now. But what I remember talking about in the past a lot was that I had like limited options with glass a lot of the time. I didn't really always have the lenses that I would have preferred. And so I've kind of made a collection of that now with this Canon stuff. I've got a Canon camera, and so I can throw all those lenses on and have that same flexibility that I have with my digital set, but just with this this film body that I get to shoot a roll through. So I kind of save the film stuff for when it's a thing that I want. But what I've noticed, though, for a little while is that I miss a lot of those moments, and I end up just having the normal, you know, the regular digital camera with me with a bunch of my other gear. When I've been going out, I've been trying to kind of just take the camera with me, and then I'll leave the bigger bag back at the truck so that I'm not really carrying as much stuff with me. I've also started carrying, like when I'm out here in the woods and stuff, I'm carrying a binocular harness with me, which is kind of cool. You can get them in different sizes, but it's sort of like, if you imagine like a backpack, but what they do is they strap onto the front, so it's right on your chest. And what you can do is put like a pair of binoculars in there. So you can pull them out and then scout around with your binoculars, do some glassing, and then pop them back into your harness, and then kind of carry on with whatever you want to do. But if you leave that empty without the binoculars, if you have a smaller camera rig, probably like a mirrorless or a Sony camera, you know, like one of those Sony A6000s, man, if you were a backpacker and you had a Sony A6000 and this front carry, binocular pack, you'd be really set. That would be like all the camera bag that you'd need. In fact, really, if I'm thinking about ever doing some some longer backpacking travel where I just have to pack everything in and weight's going to be something I'm more conscious of, then I think that's really like the way to go. As I've kind of been thinking about it a little bit, is like get a lighter camera. Or I mean, it'd be great to like carry like a 360 camera, you know, if you're going up somewhere. Those are almost nothing as it is anyway. But if you're carrying like an SLR or something that you want to try and do some more controlled photography with, and you had something like an A6000 from Sony or an A7R3 or whatever it is, something that size with a lens attached to it, you know, that could fit in one of these binocular harnesses and carry kind of right on your front. And then, oh, you see something, you want to take it. Pop that open right on your chest, pull it right up to your eye. It's got straps on it in the harness. Pull it right up to your eye. It's ready to shoot. And you can take photos of it or take photos, you know, as quick as you want to. So it's kind of a cool process if you're out hiking a lot. For what I'm doing, I have my binocular harness, but it's got binoculars in it. And I've been kind of going around. I've been trying to do some bird watching stuff while I'm out here. And I saw a cool hawk that was posted up who was looking at me. That's about all I've seen so far. I saw a coyote the other day. That was cool. I'll talk about that later, though. But so I have those binoculars in there, and I've been kind of going out on these shorter hikes and stuff. But I've been trying to go around and like just kind of watch some stuff or watch the land and kind of keep an eye out. But I just have the camera on my longer strap on my side with that 17 to 40 millimeter lens, and that's worked really good. And it's been a pretty flexible kit for me to go around and take a bunch of photographs with. So it's pretty easy, pretty lightweight to work with, and I can kind of move back and forth between those things strapped around my neck. You know, it's not everything just hanging around my neck with a lanyard. It's all kind of put somewhere or packed in somewhere. So that's been kind of cool. But it was good going out, taking some photos tonight. I was trying to get some of the I didn't get any lightning in the camera though. The lightning storm kind of passed as soon as it was getting really dark enough to do like a long exposure kind of thing where I could sort of catch something sparking. Otherwise, you know, you gotta beat the lightning bolt with your shutter finger, and that's a pretty tricky task to do. I think that's how they do it. You know, when you get those like magazine photos back in the day of a powerful lightning bolt striking, I don't know, in the center of a road or something like that. That's what they'd show, you know, some kind of power or lightning bolt. But the way that they would do that stuff is I think it was like it was dark out, you know, or pretty dark out. And so they'd set the camera up for just a cycle of long exposures, and then they would just kind of let it ride, you know. So they'd have a couple seconds to expose the image to whatever, you know, would work. And then they would just kind of have that rolling so that when a bolt of lightning did strike, and it would be captured, and you could go through that collection of captured, or, you know, how do I say that? When a lightning bolt would strike the ground, the camera would have already been exposing for a photograph because it's just cycling the shutter on a 4-second exposure, let's say something like that. And so, you know, it takes a 4-second exposure, stops, processes for a second, takes a 4-second exposure, stops, processes for a second. So I think that's how they did some of that stuff where they kind of anticipate, all right, it's been a couple of minutes, let's take a frame now, and then it's just going to be an event in the future, so we don't know if it's going to happen or not. We're going to wait for this event in the future when we, boom, see a lightning bolt, and then that light then exposes the sensor or the film and the camera. And then you're left with an image that has that lightning bolt represented in the frame when you're shooting on a tripod or something like that with a short cycle, long exposure. And I thought that was pretty cool, but I didn't really get a chance to get all that stuff set up before the storm kind of passed me by. I did get a lot of cool handheld stuff that's great, of the Thunderheads and stuff. And really, unfortunately, just in the location that I'm at, a lot of the, and I guess maybe for the better, but that lightning storm didn't pass right over my head. It was still a little ways away, so I could see the lightning bolts cracking through the trees kind of out in the distance more. A few that stretched across the sky pretty good too. It was just, you know, a big old, you know, from east to west, it was like, you know, a big old chunk of a bolt that just crack all the way across the sky. It was cool. So I got some photos of the Thunderheads, the sunset, the big field out here. It's cool. It's a nice area. But I was also thinking about some of the other stuff that I want to be doing tomorrow. So I'm out in the Fremont National Forest. I'm going to be heading, I think, maybe south from here, and I'm going to try and explore a couple areas that are still open. I guess it's all open public land. This is like a pretty large contiguous section of national forest land here. And really, like, that's a big part of Oregon overall, right? It's like 53% public lands. It's cool. Yeah, if you look at a map, you'll see the cities and you'll see like the highways and stuff. But if you have the right map, it'll show you where the BLM land is and where the different national forests are. And it's cool. This whole area, the Northwest, is just, there's a lot of public land that you get to use, and there's a lot of open area that you get to go to. And yeah, now that I've got a good map of the outdoor off-road roads and some of the terrain and stuff with some good notes, and I'm able to kind of move around and get out to a lot more places than I had before. So it's been cool. The app that I'm using is the OnX Off-Road app. It's, I think, $29.99 a year. And so I pitched that out, picked up this app, and then you can download offline these really detailed off-road maps that are supposed to show you all the trails, you know, even just walking trails, all the roads, all of the like the pieces of information you'd need for kind of moving around in the backcountry. And really, as surprising as it is, as remote as a lot of these places are, people go here. You know, it's also public land that's managed by the Forest Service. Yeah, I think a lot of the stuff's managed by the Forest Service. The BLM stuff's managed by the BLM. But that's why these roads are as good as they are, or maintained, or that's why, like, when trees are downed on these mountain roads, you know, someone has to go through at the beginning of the year and cut all those out, rip them out, fill in the potholes, all that sort of stuff. So all these areas are known about and, you know, kind of managed in a pretty significant way. In fact, I think more so to come in the future. I think they just have announced yesterday or the day before that they've passed the Great American Outdoors Act, which I really don't know the first thing about or what it does or doesn't do or what it puts in or leaves out. But I think part of my understanding is that it's supposed to change some of the funding mechanisms that go into supporting the maintenance of these public lands that are out here across the country, but really significantly out here in the western states. So it's pretty cool. I think before that, it was like, well, we should spend X amount of money, but there's a more important place for that money to go. So it wasn't like a guaranteed amount, is sort of what I understand. So if I understand it correctly, there's like, I think they've said $3 billion a year of mandated funding for projects, I think here in the backcountry, BLM land, Forest Service land, and like national wildlife refuges and stuff. So pretty cool. But yeah, I think that's going to, well, maybe we'll see a change in that. I think it's supposed to better fund the operations of BLM and Forest Service people as they're going through and trying to get these areas ready for the public to be using more regularly. So it's cool. I think it'll mean a lot over the next few years, or we'll see how it kind of transforms some of the way that these areas are managed. I think maybe it's more for, well, I probably shouldn't even speculate. I'm not sure at all, but it's pretty cool. I'm excited about being out here and doing some camping and stuff, dealing with this thunderstorm. I think it's one of those things where by the morning, it's going to be, I was looking at the weather. It should be mostly cloudy or partly cloudy, mostly sunny tomorrow for a while. So I think that's pretty cool. I'm excited to be hanging out, doing some camping stuff, doing some podcasting. I'm in the back of my truck right now. Like I was saying, it was raining earlier after those thunderstorms, so I got that canopy on my truck, and I'm nice and dry, nice and warm. It kind of feels like I'm just inside somewhere. So it's a cool rig, having the four-wheel drive, having the canopy on the back, having your stuff and your sleeping area just kind of set up back there, and I'm ready to go. So I've been having a good time being out here, and I don't know, it's been pretty good trip so far. So I appreciate you guys checking out this podcast from me. I'm going to do a couple more podcasts while I'm out here on this camping trip, and I'll try and set up a little backlog of them on my website. I think that'll be a good idea. I know I kind of take big breaks and stuff from it. I'm sure no one keeps listening when it is there. But hey, if you listen to this end of the podcast, shoot me an email. Time for the plugs. It's BillyNewmanPhoto.com. If you want to check out my website, see some of my photographs, check out more podcasts that I've done or books that I've tried to put together, which is maybe what I'm going to try and do out here too. I'm going to try and get some photographs for another good book. You can check out more information at BillyNewmanPhoto.com. You can go to BillyNewmanPhoto.com/support if you want to help me out and participate in the value for value model that we're running this podcast with. If you receive some value out of some of the stuff that I was talking about, you're welcome to help me out and send some value my way through the portal at BillyNewmanPhoto.com/support. You can also find more information there about Patreon and the way that I use it. If you're interested or feel more comfortable using Patreon, that's Patreon.com/BillyNewmanPhoto.
I've been trying to learn Unix. I've been trying to learn like the Mac OS command line terminal stuff. I don't know if you guys have learned any stuff in a shell language before. Way back, like years ago, like back in the 90s, you guys might remember when you got your first PC at the family. And like when I was a kid, I really wanted to play video games. I wanted to play video games so bad. But all the video game installation systems for Windows PCs, they were all this DOS-based system. So you had to put in the disk, and then you had to like go into DOS and then change it from the C drive to the D drive and then do some command line thing that I did not understand at all at the time. Any of those directions were way over my head. So it was always like so hard and frustrating. I remember just having kind of like panicked frustrations about trying to get command lines to work and not understanding what you're supposed to type in or that there's commands you're supposed to put in. It was always so frustrating. I learned it a little bit, and I'd gotten into computers when I was young, and so I figured out some DOS stuff early, but I was never proficient in it. I could never really move about a file system in a command line before. And so it was cool. I didn't really know anything about the Mac OS system. I know that it's Darwin. I know that Mac OS was based on Unix and like the Unix file handling system, kind of the same way that like Linux is based on that. And Unix is like the old command line system of file management stuff. I think that was back... there's all sorts of stuff I don't understand, because there's like the PowerShell system, which I guess is more for scripting languages, or for... I guess there's a lot of powerful stuff you can do on that server side, and then there's a lot of stuff originally that stuff was set up as, where it's like more like a file cabinet system. And I've been kind of learning about that. I'm not an expert on any terminal stuff by any means, but it's been really cool kind of getting a bit more understanding about how to get powerful use out of a Macintosh computer. And it was cool learning a few commands on it. I guess if anybody wants to try it, I'd go into... Well, I'll tell you what I've been doing. I don't know if you guys would want to do this, but I've been going into Terminal. I installed a new shell in Terminal called Fish. When you first get started with shell or with the Terminal on Mac, it's the Bash shell. You can learn, I guess, what that stands for. It's like the Born Again shell. I don't know. It's something that came out in the 70s. It's, you know, it's like early 70s, right? I don't know. This stuff goes way back for computer stuff. But I installed like an updated shell that gives me a couple different color modifiers, and it kind of helps fill in, it helps auto-complete some of the stuff that you're trying to do on command line, which saves a ton of time and makes my syntax use way easier, because I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know when to put a space. Do I put a dash and then a space and then a letter, or do I just not, or how do I pipe a command? What am I doing here? So none of that stuff I really understand, and so the auto-completion stuff of a more modern shell that you install on top of that makes a big difference. But first, it takes a huge amount of time. I guess you can type in man, and that will bring up like the manual for Unix or for all the Unix commands. You can kind of get a handle on how to learn that, but really the best way is to go to YouTube and to follow a tutorial for a while of learning some of the basic commands. Some of the basic ones that I've learned is like cd for change directory. That's how you like move from one file to the next file. So if you're in like, oh, I'm in my users folder, but I'm going to go to my documents folder now. So you do cd documents, and then it moves you to that. Then you type in ls to list the contents of the folders in that. And then like you look at that, and then you can open up those programs in a writing program, or you can create files. That's been really cool. I've learned how to do that. The other part I've been learning is... And I've not messed with this before either, but is with like Homebrew, which I guess is a package manager. It's kind of so you can download programs from the internet, or you can download additional utilities or applications into Terminal and then run them from Terminal. It's pretty cool. There's ways you can do more advanced things where you can get, you know, just like your Mac OS apps that you would probably likely want to download. You can get those through Terminal if you'd want to install. But with a lot of these installation packages, it's for these really interesting kind of applications that are quite old, like they're 20 or 25 years old. Like I downloaded an email program that was new, right? It was a command line email program, I think called Alpine. It was made by like the University of Washington back in 2001 was the last time it was updated. And you're like, hey, wow, that's pretty new software. No way, that's cool. But you can look around and there's all these different formulas. Like there's MP3 players, there's file converters, there's video converters, MPEG converters, there's like system utilities, there's disk usage utilities, there's networking utilities, there's games. Like I put Zork on there, I put Tetris on there. I've been trying to like learn a few things on just, you know, how to open stuff, how to run stuff in there. And it's been kind of cool. There's all sorts of environments in there that I just had no idea really existed. But there's a whole like functioning computer system that existed without the graphical user interface that we put so much time into. So anyway, it's been fun. It's just kind of a hobby thing, but I've been trying to learn a little bit of productivity out of it too, because there's, like I would ever do this, but there are some interesting things that you can do. One of the commands that I thought was interesting was the sips command. You can probably look that up, like man sips, man space sips for the manual for the command sips. But I guess that's the like a Macintosh image processing thing, something, commands, system. I don't know what it does completely, but there's cool things you can do with that, where if you have a folder of images, say you find a directory and it's got a folder of images, but those are all large images and you want to resize those for the web, you can duplicate that folder. This would be the process I would do. Is in the GUI, I would make a copy of that folder. I would navigate to that in command line and I would type a command like sips space and then the name of the folder, or like the size of pixels I want the image, and then the name of the folder. And it would process, in the command line, it would process all of those images to be resized to that format and to that size. So it was interesting. I did an experiment like where I was taking some photos that were like 5 megapixel images, and then I would drop those down to 400 width pixels. Or, you know, like a 400 pixel width image that I could put up on a website. And it was cool. I could just take the whole folder, and then I could write the command, and then you could see it process out all those images, and then you go back, and it would be a resized image. It was really cool. But it's just interesting kind of seeing your computer work and then understanding how to layer in commands and get some action out of it. I hardly know how to do anything. I'm totally novice at it. I can barely kind of move up and down the file system and get something interesting to look at. But most of all, it's just kind of me like looking at it and go, huh, how about that? But I don't know how to use it at all. I mean, there's so many system developers or like network analysts or, you know, people that actually like get into computers that aren't in media. And for computer development or for application development, there's still like a whole range of uses and applications and systems that people that are in that really get into quite deeply. So you can kind of see like how powerful these tools are. And at a certain level, when you're trying to get into powerful tools, you just move into terminal. You move into everything that you can do in Unix. It's really interesting. So it's been kind of fun to do. I'll talk about it more in kind of a fun, goofy way. But yeah, man, getting into Unix.
Thanks a lot for checking out this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast. Hope you guys check out some stuff on billynewmanphoto.com. Few new things up there, some stuff on the homepage, some good links to other outbound sources, some links to books, some links to some podcasts, links to some blog posts, all pretty cool. But yeah, check it out at billynewmanphoto.com. Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of the podcast. Talk to you next time.